my name's Claire Nurse. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Geography and Environment here at the LSE. And I'm absolutely delighted to welcome you here this evening to celebrate with us the achievement of our colleague Austin Seidel, the publication of this book. What I'm going to do is just go through a couple of proceedings with you. First of all, I need to tell you where the fire assembly point is, which is outside the Sarsfield-Hock Student Centre, and stewards will show you where to go in the event that we need to convene there. Also, I'd just like to explain how the event is going to proceed this evening. I'm going to hand over to my colleague Austin Seidelman, who will talk a little bit about the book, and then we will have each of our panellists, whom I will introduce to you shortly, who will each speak for about 10 minutes on the issues raised by the book. Then there will be open questions from the audience for discussion, and we aim to finish around 7:15 or so, and there will be a wine reception afterwards. And there is also an opportunity to purchase a book at the corner during the reception, I understand, for a very good discounted rate for those of you who are interested. I'd also like to say that the Twitter hashtag, for those of you who feel so inclined, is hashtag... hashtag LSE Geography or hashtag LSE Jog UPD, but that's obviously more difficult to remember, so let's just go with hashtag LSE Geography. Okay, I'd also just quickly like to remind you that the event is recorded and we hope that there will be a podcast that will be made available online afterwards. Please, if you're in the audience with a mobile phone, could you turn it to silent to avoid disrupting the event? And so let me now turn to introduce our speakers this evening. Our first speaker is Dr. Austin Seidelman, my colleague here in the Department of Geography and Environment. Austin is an interdisciplinary scholar who specialises in the cultural and political dimensions of cities, with a specific focus on Latin America. And his research adopts an ethnographic and historical approach to contemporary forms of urbanism. He's particularly interested in how cities are planned, built, governed, and inhabited in anticipation of uncertain futures. And we're going to hear more about his interests as he talks to us about his book, published by Duke University Press, which has just been made available, which is entitled Endangered City: The Politics of Security and Risk in Bogota. Our second panellist this evening is Professor Matthew Gandy, who is Professor of Cultural and Historical Geography and Fellow of King's College at the University of Cambridge. Matthew is a cultural, urban and environmental geographer with particular interest in landscape, infrastructure and, more recently, biodiversity. He's particularly interested in aspects of environmental history, including epidemiology and the contemporary intersections between nature and culture, including the visual arts. He's the co-founder of the Urban Salon, which is here in London, and he's the co-editor of the journal International Journal of Urban and Regional Research. He is also the author of Moth, which is published by Reaction Press this year, and in fact the book launch is being held tomorrow night at the Stoke Newington Bookshop. He's also the author of 2014, The Fabric of Space, Water Modernity and the Urban Imagination, published by MIT Press, and in 2002, Concrete and Clay, Reworking Nature in New York City, also published by MIT Press. Speaking after Matthew will be Professor Gareth Jones here at the Department of Geography and Environment. Gareth is Professor of Urban Geography, Director of the Latin America and Caribbean Centre and part of the Institute for Global Affairs, and he's also Associate Member of the International Inequalities Institute here at the LSE. His research interests are in urban geography with a particular interest in how people make use of the city, how cities are represented by policy and in practice. And he's done research in Mexico, Colombia, Ecuador, Brazil, India, Ghana and South Africa. He's editor with Dennis Rogers of Youth Violence in Latin America, Gangs and Juvenile Justice in Perspective, published by Macmillan Palgrave, and he's currently a co-principal investigator on an ESRC co-funded grant with colleagues in Amsterdam and LMU. Where's LMU?
Munich.
In Munich. And they are investigating the commodification of urban poverty and violence in four cities in the Americas: Kingston, Mexico City, Rio de Janeiro, and New Orleans. And our final panelist this evening is Dr. Kate McLean, who's a senior lecturer in social geography at Birkbeck, the University of London. Kate is a feminist geographer who explores the way that development, economic and financial theories and policies recreate, challenge and impact upon gendered concepts, identities and experience. She's done research in Bolivia, Colombia, Mexico, Mali and Burkina Faso. She's worked on microfinance, rural livelihoods, the financial crisis, contraband and urban regeneration, mostly with a focus on Latin America. And she's author of the recently published book in 2015, The Social Urbanism and the Politics of Violence, The Medellin Miracle. It gives me great pleasure to pass over to my colleague Austin, who's going to talk to us about security, risk and urban imagination.
Well, thanks, Claire, for such a generous and welcoming introduction. And let me just start by saying a few thank yous. So thanks, first of all, to the panelists for your willingness to join me in this event at a particularly busy time of year. Thanks to you all, the audience, for coming out at a rather strange day in terms of weather. And that's a steel line from my stepfather this morning, who said that the weather actually mimics the cover of the book, which must be a good thing. So thank you for coming out on a particularly sort of endangered day. So I also want to express gratitude to those who made the event possible. So my own department at the LSE, Geography and Environment, as well as the Center for Latin American and Caribbean Studies, both gave generous support for the event. Catherine Mitchell has done an amazing job in all things logistical, so thanks, Catherine, and also the labor of everyone behind the scenes that's made this possible is also much appreciated. And finally, I want to extend a special thanks to a group of people who I don't often get to acknowledge in an academic context, my parental assemblage, for lack of a better word. My mom, dad, Colin, Steph, and as well as my partner, Paula. So it means a tremendous amount to me to have you all here with me today. Now, I have to admit, it took some encouragement from friends and colleagues before I reluctantly decided to hold an event to mark the publication of the book that's sort of sitting awkwardly on the back table over there. Once I decided to go ahead with that idea, I still didn't want to make it all about sort of me and my book. I also didn't want to force Claire and Matthew and Kate and Gareth to read an extra 212 pages at this time of year. So the idea was to invite them to speak to the broader theme that we've titled the event around, which is security, risk, and the urban imagination. And to do so, and to feel free to do so, from the perspective of their own work. So all three of them have done, as Claire has already mentioned, important work on the subject from a variety of different perspectives, and indeed have influenced my own thinking. So it's really a pleasure to get to share a panel with them on this occasion, and I really look forward to hearing their thoughts. But that said, all I know about this topic is what is in the book, so I'm going to have to talk about the book, like it or not. So what I'm going to do is give you a very short sort of preview, very brief, in hopes that I convince you to sort of take a deeper look and to notice I didn't say purchase it, though as Claire mentioned, you're welcome to do so. Now, the book's entitled Endangered Cities, so I thought I should perhaps start by explaining why it is that endangerment became, for me, a particularly useful way of conceptualizing the phenomena I was trying to describe in the book. So when I first arrived in Bogota around 2006, the city was safer than it had been for quite a while. But there was something paradoxical about that change. The atmosphere was more relaxed, but yet many of the same anxieties still remained. Now, during my field work, the bulk of which took place between 2008 and 2010, friends and strangers alike encouraged me to see the city as a threat-ridden place and taught me strategies for basically negotiating the city as such. Now, Teresa Caldera, who some of you will know, was an early inspiration and eventual mentor of mine. What she had emphasized in her book, City of Walls, as a talk of crime, here was somewhat more generalized, I think, as a talk of danger. People often drew me maps dividing the city between no-go areas and safe zones, and I first assumed that it was my status as kind of clueless outsider that prompted these sorts of warnings. But after time, I mean, this went from things like obvious precautions, like closing car windows and traffic jams, to more eccentric ones like something called El Sereno. And for those who spent time in Bogota, I might share an appreciation for that particular danger. But when I started field work in the hillside settlements of Bogota's southern periphery, where a lot of people had actually warned me or advised me not to go, those warnings became all the more pronounced. And over time, I eventually came to see them, these precautions, not as some kind of strange superstitions, right, or paranoia, some kind of exotic tribe or something like that, but as cultural practices particularly suited to everyday life in a city generally understood to be, to a certain degree, fraught with danger. Now, not long before the period of my fieldwork, assassinations, bombings, kidnappings were almost routine. And it stands to reason, I think, that people who lived through that Bogota would orient their lives in relationship to threats of many kinds. But, and I probably don't need to remind some of you of this, this is the very same time urbanists and security experts from around the world were, in fact, heralding the dawn of a new age for Bogota. This was the kind of language in which the city was being spoken about at the time, indeed celebrating the city's rebirth, as it was often called. Now, that paradox eventually prompted me to start thinking less about danger and more about endangerment. Now, of course, they're cognates, but there's subtle differences between the terms. Both suggest the possibility of imminent harm, something on the horizon, rather than its immediate reality. But danger indicates a specific threat, right? Something concrete, tangible, immediate, while endangerment refers to the more general condition of being threatened. And they also exist in different temporalities. Danger is immediate, short-term, it may dissipate when time passes or conditions change. Endangerment, on the other hand, is lasting, it's open-ended. The possibility of harm is sustained indefinitely. So in a sense, then, the book is not so much about the direct experience of danger as it is about how endangerment more indirectly conditions experiences of the city. Now, I think this kind of framing is helpful for thinking about cultural, social, and political life in places like Bogotá. And in some ways, it's familiar from studies that those in sort of studies of security or studies of violence or conflict will be familiar with around things like lasting trauma or persistent cultures of fear, that sort of stuff. Now, the book, in some ways, tries to extend that way of thinking, sort of build on that, to learn from that, but to extend it into the domain of what I think of as urban politics and government, more to the relationship between state and citizen, the city as a political community. And just as an aside, this is one reason why I was adamant about resisting the current trend to do away with the city as a concept. It's sort of no longer PC. Don't get me started on that. It's a topic for another conversation. A focus on endangerment, I think, allows us to understand, first of all, how the state establishes and maintains its authority and legitimacy, how government intervenes in the lives of its citizens, how citizens inhabit the city as political subjects, and how these subjects position themselves when actually addressing the state. So in sum, it's sort of a way of apprehending the politics of security and the government of risk and their implications for contemporary cities and urban life. Now, this inevitably leads to questions of scale and of generality. And I hope some of you would be asking yourselves, is this unique to a place like Bogotá? Is this specific to Latin America? Is this something common to cities of the global south? Is this a salient example of something more worldwide, a kind of worldwide anxiety? Is Colombia a particularly convenient or inconveniently particular place to talk about the topic of today, security risk in the urban imagination? Now, the answer in the book is sort of yes to all of the above. Certain parts are specific to Bogotá. Other parts, I think, are addressed to cities of the global south. Others are to contemporary urbanism at large. So in a sense, that tension is intentional in the book. But ultimately, my own sort of disciplinary training and formation as an anthropologist, become geographer, eventually comes out. And I want to argue that examining the politics of security and risk in contemporary cities requires recognizing some very key specificities, things like historical conditions, cultural sensibilities, political contingencies that are certainly not the same everywhere. In other words, cities like Bogota, Philadelphia, and London, three cities that I know fairly well, can all be understood to a certain degree as endangered, but in very different ways and with very different effects. Now, a few examples, just to sort of touch upon them, and this is what the book spends the majority of its time discussing, how security and risk in Bogotá are concerns shared across the political spectrum that political actors from left to right must, to some degree, take into account in order to do their work, in order to be successful. And therefore, it's a contested kind of political domain in which many things happen. It also emerges out of a long history, of course, a long history of political violence and armed conflict in Colombia, which sets the conditions of possibility for how urban life can actually be governed but also be lived in the present. Security and risk also shape what I call the terrain of political engagement for many people in the city, but perhaps most significantly for the urban poor. So I argue that rights and citizenship, very basic things like that, or urban citizenship, are directly tied to one's vulnerability, to being vulnerable, or to being at risk, or to being in some condition of insecurity. And then finally, security and risk become the basis for all sorts of future projects, beyond just protecting one's life from hazard, beyond securing things that are important. Things like getting a new house from the perspective of somebody who is classified as at risk. Perhaps redistributing public goods from the perspective of somebody who's managing one of the governmental programs for risk management. So the point here, then, is that we can't necessarily predict the ways in which these kind of politics of security and risk unfold in different places. And I think that's an open question that deserves more research. Now, if these are some of the specificities of the politics of security and risk in Bogotá, I still want to ask, what can they tell us about what we might think of, sort of borrowing a phrase from some of Matthew's work about the urban imagination at large? Now, in recent years, a growing list of catastrophic events has contributed to a mounting sense that we now live in a sort of world historical age of uncertainty and insecurity. Now, across many different domains of expertise, people seem to agree that catastrophes and crises are globally on the rise. Now, all around us are signs of an urban imagination that essentially envisions cities in this rather dystopian light. So you have the belief that the world has entered a kind of time of singular uncertainty, and I think with that belief comes a new political imperative. So, in other words, to govern the present of cities, in anticipation of future harm. Now, Endangered Cities, essentially the book that is about that imperative, and in particular its consequences for cities and for people who live in them. And as I said, given Colombia's particular sort of late 20th century history, long-running struggle with conflict and violence, Bogotá then becomes an especially good place to think about how security and risk are changing essentially what it means to be a 21st century city and a 21st century urban citizen. Now, in some ways, this trend could be read as signaling a break. Now, a break from sort of evolutionary models of development. And these models of development that were central to kind of modernist paradigms of urbanism. And this, on some level, is related to these claims that I think we see all around us coming from expert communities, that the world has, as I said, entered this kind of new age of uncertainty. That history is no longer the story of kind of progressive improvement, betterment, development, etc. But I think this is also related to arguments coming more from sort of critical urbanists, urban studies, that cities should no longer be expected to follow in the footsteps of the so-called kind of great modern metropolises of Europe and North America. Now, in some particularly perhaps unexpected ways, this dovetails with the notion that the global urban future is now radically uncertain. And I think these modes of thought do important work. First of all, they reconfigure how we understand urban modernity, and I think in some very important and necessary ways. But they also perhaps, and I think perhaps inadvertently here, lend weight to models of urbanism organized around security and risk, the phenomenon designated here as the endangered city. And just to expand upon that a little bit, when a teleology of progress is discarded and cities are viewed as problems of security and risk, rather than, say, development, we may see that resources once dedicated to things like housing, healthcare, education are reduced and redirected to the more basic goals of protection, preparedness, or even just basically survival. And this is one of my main concerns about the fate of cities today. But in returning to the argument that I was making a second ago, while models of urbanism organized around risk and security may draw attention away from other kind of social and political problems, my aim is not somehow to denounce these models. For, as I said, we can't really predict what they come to mean or what they actually come to do in particular locations. And as I said in Bogota, and we can talk about this in more detail afterwards, they actually unfold in some rather interesting, surprising, and sometimes actually promising sorts of ways. What does deserve sustained scrutiny, though, I think, is the degree to which endangerment has become, or is becoming, an essential feature of a new paradigm of planning, of development, of governance, of actually inhabiting cities. Certainly not the only one, but I think there is cause to talk about it as an important, perhaps, contribution to new paradigms of urbanism. And I think that ultimately urges us to ask, and this is what I'm trying to ultimately do here, is to ask, what does it mean to see the future of cities and the cities of future as problems of risk and security, as problems of threat and hazard, in some as endangered? I don't think that exhausts the limits of possibility of how we can actually imagine urban futures today. And so the wager that I have is that actually other kinds of futures beyond the endangered city remain to be invented. So in some ways, the book is ultimately a kind of push to all of us to think beyond it. So I'd now like to turn things over to our panelists, who, as Claire said, will speak for about 10 minutes or so each, after which we'll have time for questions and discussion, and then wine. So thanks very much.
Say a few words about Austin's book, Endangered City. In a way, I'm doing not what I was asked to do, because I'm going to talk directly about the book, because I think it's a really important piece of work, and I have some reflections on it. I think the first point to make is that the book is meticulously researched. I think it's a model of combining different sources, both contemporary and historical, without flattening the nuance of specific historical moments. And in particular, I like Austin's phrase about giving ethnographic accounts and historical depth. And in reading the book, I was struck, for example, by some of the very detailed ethnographic accounts of particular people that Austin spoke to and got to know during the course of the research. Helena's story, for example, and the threats that this woman faced in terms of people coming to her home and trying to threaten her with violence to extract rent from her, and this dynamic of rent appropriation from the poor, and these micro spaces of threat and threatened violence, which I think is very powerfully evoked in the book. Another point about the book, I think it's highly original. I think that Austin develops a subtle theoretical framework that displays a complete mastery, I think, of an extraordinary range of sources across a range of fields. It's strongly interdisciplinary. And he's able to locate his study very carefully in relation to existing debates. So in this way, I think the book pushes against the margins of current theory and poses a series of novel questions and insights. In terms of setting up these different bodies of theoretical work, some of the questions that the book left me with that I would like to maybe discuss more with Austin, or maybe he'll develop in other works, he sets up in a way a frame of urban political economy, and then also what he refers to as neoliberal governmentality, which he frames in relation to a series of biopolitical discussions. And I would be very interested to see how some of the connections that Austin traces towards James Ferguson's work on the progressive arts of government, for example, which he cites in this book, how those strands might be further developed. And in relation to the biopolitical, this complex relationship between populations or conceptualizations of a population and the individual, and some very interesting questions really came to my mind. Another strand that I like within the book are these conceptual lineages to the post-colonial, and another point of discussion might be the way in which Partha Chatterjee and other post-colonial theorists in an Indian context, counterposing the civil and the political, how these bodies of work might speak to the Colombian experience, and really developing these intellectual dialogues or exchanges within and between different contexts within the global south, I think is potentially very interesting. I like the way that Austin gives attention to, if you like, non-teleological periodicities. He's very careful in the way he uses historical moments within his analysis. And Austin is also very sensitive to the geographies of knowledge production itself. I think this is something that comes through very powerfully in the book. I like the way that he uses the term zone in a variety of different contexts, evocatively bringing together elements of the cartographic, governmental, and also the imaginary within a frame of reference. I like also the imaginative ways in which different ideas are placed together to create sometimes uneasy or unstable combinations, and I think this is very provocative. One of the key terms or phrases that emerges from Austin's book is the idea of multiple forms of endangerment, and really exploring the shifting boundaries between the natural and the social, and in particular, the imperative to work towards the denaturalization of many of these phenomena. I think that's very powerfully developed through the book. Austin also raises the questions of citizenship and the ideal citizen, and this is really strikingly illustrated by the death of Omeira Sanchez, a woman who was killed in a mudslide over an extended period of time. She was trapped and filmed and became a focus of intense public interest. And this extraordinarily powerful moment in the book made me think of Susan Sontag's writing on the power of photography, and also her book regarding the pain of others, and possibly also Judith Butler's concern with which lives are mournable, and the way in which this might be folded in to a deeper sense of what an ideal citizen or citizenship really means. And I sense that as the book develops, there's a push towards some understanding of a securitized citizenship and some way of articulating a different understanding of what a citizenship actually means. In terms of the geographical links between different cities, I like the way that Austin reverses the simplistic ideas that, say, the cities of Europe or North America might be becoming more like cities in the global south. He rather reverses this so that we might reflect on how Bogota is becoming a bit more like Brussels or Berlin. So it's a kind of a reverse frame. That's what I got from that. I also thought that the discussion about epidemics and disease was very interesting, the swine flu epidemic. And I'd be very interested to hear from Austin what he makes of the recent Zika virus. And in particular, some of these examples of political theatre as epidemiological intervention, and maybe certain parallels between these different instances. I would say another broad point about the book, that it's beautifully written. It's very, very impressive in the way that it's written. I think that the way it's written is vivid, incisive, and it also manages to juggle different narrative threads simultaneously. The conceptual, the historical, the ethnographic are brought together in a very powerful combination. Austin also, in his writing, makes a very judicious choice of words. He really avoids some of the subdisciplinary jargon or deliberate obfuscation, which I think cuts off important writing from potentially wider audiences. For example, the way in which he describes how he's approached the question of violence obliquely is really interesting as a way of handling that. He also uses some linguistic metaphors, which I really like, such as the subjunctive state, which he introduces later in the book. So this question then of the use of language and writing are very prominent within the book. And then my final point is that really more of a broader disciplinary observation. I think it's really great that anthropologists or people working within an anthropology context are being hired by geography departments. I think that's really great for us. I'm speaking momentarily as a geographer. I think that the publishing of books is really important as a research output. In some departments, it's almost a transgressive act. So if this is transgressive, that's great. It really has a wider impact. I think also as an anthropologist, I think Austin takes methodology very seriously. And this attention to long-term, detailed, and often difficult ethnographic work as part of the research process should be defended and celebrated, and is brilliantly set out within this book. And possibly this attention to methodological depth and concrete research might be contrasted with desk-based generalities for less interesting ways of approaching the urban question. And then finally to this question of the book, I think that Duke University Press have done a wonderful job with it. I think it's a book to own. It gets that limited space on the shelf. It competes with all the other accoutrements of our lives. It's found its space. I think it's a book to reread and also grow with. I mean, my copy's already full of scribbled pencil annotations, and it's part of my library. I'm really happy to have it.
Matthew, not talking so much about his own research, but talking about the book, because I feared that what I was going to have to say, which is almost entirely about the book, would be somehow sort of bookended, no pun, between two other sort of talks, and I'd be seeing very much out of place. The bit in the memo that I read was say a few words up to 10 to 12 minutes, and didn't really scan too much about what. Too many memos. I'm going to read many of my comments so that in some vain attempt at coherence. Twice in the last few days, Austin has assured me that this book only needed, quote, a quick scan, a skim, just take a look, say a few words. But this is certainly, as Matthew's already pointed out, a book that rewards those with time to provide a closer read. It's a book that I think could join a canon of recent work in anthropology, and I'm thinking particularly about Daniel Goldstein's Spectacular City, Thomas Book Hansen's Melancholia of Freedom, Kristen Peterson's Speculative Market, books that all offer insightful depictions of the dynamics of urban life at a city scale, whatever the problematics of the city in that context. The titular nods to temporalities in the titles of those books, Spectacular, Speculative, Melancholy, may not be entirely incoincidental either to the sort of temporalities of the issues that Austin has already drawn out. Indeed, although Endangered City is grounded in the specifics of particular neighbourhoods, what I really like about it is, amongst other things, is it tells us much about the rationales of the state, as it does about everyday lives, about how the conditions through which these lives take place are linked with the past, and also about the future. And this is very much one of those books, and this is a good thing, in which as I was reading it, I found my mind sort of wandering off into other places. There was a sort of internal monologue developed, sometimes about particular places described in the book, such as Calle El Cartucho in Bogota, which I visited long ago now, so it aged me, I'm afraid, long before Peñalosa got his little hands on it. But also to places I've revisited for research more recently, such as Rio de Janeiro. Last week, in the favela of Providencia, a space contested by drug traffickers and military police. It is very much a space considered as a danger to the city, or indeed to the idea of the city, the idea that certain forces within Rio de Janeiro want to have of themselves and of that city. And parts of the steep slopes of the favela have been identified as high risk, prompting removals, displacements, and in turn enabling a whole set of projects to redevelop this space, bringing it into sort of tourist modalities, local economic development schemes, and various sort of art projects. And although it never took off, one of the early ones of which was the Guggenheim Museum at the top of the favela. Modernist art, with all its suffering, displacing life, with all its suffering, seemed sort of so much to play with there in some sort of project, maybe. Or to New Orleans, where the Lower Ninth Ward, 12 years after Katrina, is still considered a space of risk, a space to the inhabitants who are there, to the city economy, to its ecology. And where there have been so many plans, projects, proposals written, but so little done with or for the space, that a coalition of community organisations that I was with a few weeks ago recently petitioned City Hall, quote, to stop planning our future. One of the things that really concerned them in a sort of managerial sense, and I think it's maybe something that Austin could to talk about in the more ethnographic areas of this book, is that this sort of interaction of technocratic planning and its possibilities but its never realizations and its sort of future possibles breeds politics of rumor. Who are people walking through, taking, drawing maps, taking photographs, and what is their intention, even in a more participatory and consultative guide? The book is framed by this concept of endangerment as a condition of being threatened, and that, as Austin writes, often indirectly conditions experiences of the city. Although the book is ostensibly relates to a nexus between state and its technopolitics and people, the poor subjects ambiguously identified as citizens, it seems that endangerment operates more pervasively across class, generations, gender, political affiliation, and temporalities. And it also seems, as I've alluded to with Rio and New Orleans, that endangerment and the supporting keyword concepts and neologisms of anxiety, uncertainty, insecurity, trauma, and above all risk, opens possibilities for comparative thinking without losing the specificities of Bogota in this instance or other sites that might interest us. And Austin, I think, puts this really well early on in the book where he says, the key question remains, how to conduct a genealogy of risk and security in parts of the world with histories significantly different from those of the West? And it's that interplay, as Matthew's also alluded, between the West and the non-West, the global North and South, but also the diversity of both in their histories and the present interrogations with risk, uncertainty, and danger, which is really important. Austin points out that the burden, as he puts it, of this book is to account for urban phenomena that cannot be fully understood by the paradigms of urban political economy and neoliberal governmentality. And I think he releases himself of this burden in some sort of clever ways, not least of which is approaching urban political economy, accumulation by dispossession, etc., really very critically. And that means, amongst many other things, paying really close attention to the kind of street bureaucrats, the people that make the potential of accumulation by dispossession possible, if we want to hang on to that concept, and the everyday lives of barrio residents, and avoiding only pessimistic readings of state relations with capitalism and politics that only ever seem to produce these sort of dystopian stories of abuse, displacement, and suffering. And so therefore, well into the book, when we are introduced to Liliana, I thought there was this sort of subtlety of critical engagement with urban political economy really, and other processes came through, in which Austin describes how Liliana lived outside of a zone of high risk, but it attempted to self-identify and have the state accept her as a subject of risk. By doing so, she gained rights to housing. She was brought into the zone of risk. She could therefore engage with the state in a different way and perhaps receive material benefit. And Austin summarizes this: to become a citizen with rights, Liliana first had to be visible as a life at risk. And this is something that I think happens a number of times in the book, which is the sort of the conventional sort of list of assumptions and their relation to another list of assumptions or concepts and characteristics. It's constantly being played with. Going back to Providencia, in Rio, the contest for the hill is not one in which it's necessarily uncertainty or insecurity is played out by traffickers versus police. People often feel much more insecure when neither are present. So when I was there last week, what people said what really frightened them is that nothing was happening. It was quiet. There were no police at the bottom of the hill. There were no traffickers at the top. And in the sort of future possible, what this told them is that something unknown was about to happen. Okay. And so I think that's really important. Here you've got Liliana playing risk and rights and citizenship in ways which present her with material benefits, that our sort of conventional modalities of putting clear characteristics in single silos can be somehow disrupted. Austin then does not treat these sort of concepts of anxiety, uncertainty, insecurity, and risk as absolutes, as givens, and Matthew's already used the word. What he does is bring in a great deal of nuance to their manipulation, their perversity in time and place. What he does is he looks at the work that these concepts do for the state and for political discourse and for people in their imagined or experienced relations with the current economic, political, or environmental context. If citizenship then is about the relationship of people to the political community of the city, then these kind of pervasive concepts of insecurity, fear, and risk suggest that the 21st century city might be inhabited by endangered citizens. But rather than be kind of wholly pessimistic about that, as perhaps the sort of the sort of dictionary reading of endangerment might imply, what this book does is it brings out that endangerment and citizenship are not without some agency. People can make use of these possibilities. The text therefore avoids shorthands of urban development studies that categorise whole swathes of people as somehow sort of passive, or to use an often used term, vulnerable or excluded, and recognises that risk has become mundane in everyday life to some extent, and folded into daily practices of shopping, dropping off kids at school, etc., etc., but that also can be sort of mobilised and used much more positively in engagements with the state, with political actors, with neighbours and others. In that sense, I think there's kind of two things I'd like to sort of maybe ask you to talk about in a moment. One is that I think a kind of human condition for dealing with risk is often humour, even up to the ultimate gallows humour. And I wondered how people in Bogota expressed sort of subjective reasonings of risk in less directive speech than when asked about earthquakes, floods and housing, etc. You know, well, how did humour get used as a way of expressing risk or their relations to it? And secondly, it's a sort of absence from the book, one that I'm very pleased is absent, but it's an absence nonetheless that I think needs perhaps some explanation, which is, this is the danger of sending PDFs of books, it's not until page 212 that you use the word resilience. And so I was wondering and curious but relieved as to why you don't describe people as in any way resilient, individual, community, or more sort of broader subjective level. I'm very happy that you do, having worked with people in contexts of suicides and massacres and drug-related crime and so on and so forth, I've always found this idea that people can be resilient really very difficult when they're kind of breaking down in tears in front of you and physically shaking during an interview. It seems somehow lost from the page somehow sort of pretend or protect them within some sort of concept like that. I think it's also worth pausing to consider Endangered City as a commentary on methodology. Matthew's already sort of brought Jim Ferguson into the discussion, and I think one of the things that really strikes me about the book is that methodologically it really is grounded in the field. It's not about taking concepts and theories from global south, north, or points in between necessarily into the field directly, seeing them apparently kind of map out before us, but somehow build into the narrative what is there before him in the field. And yet, in many ways, the key interlocutors of this book are not urban anthropologists or ethnographers per se. So I'm kind of interested here in how that sort of intellectual disruption takes place. This is ethnography and anthropology, but interlocutors are across a wide pluralistic spectrum of theories. It is informed by the field and from the field, and yet clearly engages with a much wider set of issues than the field itself might provide. I thought I'd also say something about how risk has entered into the world of research. The process of doing research itself seems to be implicated, I think, in the sort of technocracies of risk that this book very aptly discusses. We are, as researchers, now increasingly asked to manage risk ourselves. And it's an oddity, I think, in completing risk assessments when doing work in Rio or New Orleans or Mexico City, that the form from LSE has a section in it that says, what are you doing about the risks? The imperative you immediately suggests a responsibilization of me to do something about risks that I obviously clearly have no control over. In response to a question on how I was going to respond to, quote, natural disaster / flood in my research in New Orleans, I was tempted to put swim before opting for the more sensible follow the advice of FEMA, the Federal Emergency Management Agency, knowing, of course, that it had spectacularly failed to provide such advice in the run-up to Katrina. In Rio, what would I do in the event of, quote, bombs / bullets / mortars / mines and the security of my accommodation? I guess the answer might be find the police, assuming that they weren't the ones firing the bombs, bullets, mortars or mines or breaking into my accommodation. So I wrote, take normal precautions. I got an insurance certificate. Endangered City has more important lessons, however, about how we might conduct research ethnographically under conditions of risk and uncertainty, including in relation to violence. Lastly, I wanted to say something about how Endangered City draws attention to how time and temporality inform what happens, or how people understand what is happening now. By contrast to resilience, the word unforeseen appears numerous times in the text, highlighting how urban governance is predicated on notions of time and what might be. And yet, I think it is sort of symptomatic of temporality of the 21st century compared to maybe the mid-20th, is that as a teenager, my father gave me James Baldwin's The Fire Next Time, which includes the epigraph, appropriately enough, God gave Noah the rainbow sign, no more water, the fire next time. Baldwin used this ominous omen phrase taken from a spiritual to explore the frustrations of African-American subjectivities and the politics of mid-century United States. The future possible, the predictive, presumptive, anticipatory, precautionary, in the current moment, seems somehow kind of stripped out of that politics, that radical politics. And I maybe like you to sort of tell us more about how you see a radical politics perhaps dealing with time in the 21st century. What it seems to have done instead is empower a new set of agents of hope and disaster, the consultancy, security professionals, and military outsourcing companies. They're all really good at measuring risk and promising security. And it seems to me that whilst modernist dreams spun by architects and planners in the 20th century might have been rightly critiqued, if the cities of the 21st century are to be built by security professionals and military outsourcing companies, we might in 50 years' time look back to the 1950s and 1960s with a sense of nostalgia. There does seem to be something here about not so much cities like Bogota or Rio de Janeiro being model cities, but actually really being model cities, that they are controlled and enumerated and driven by metrics and risk assessments, just like our research of them. As such, whether one considers the present move to a post-political moment in which there is a lack of transparency as to who gets to decide how cities and their subjects are imagined and urban lives are lived, there needs to be a politics, I think, put more centrally into this relationship of citizenship and technopolitics that you so beautifully describe. In that sense, I think Securing the Future, Chapter 5, is anticipation is both a resource and a danger for the urban poor, is a kind of idea in which we could see small agency-based opportunities to describe how politics can come back in. So, to conclude very quickly, I think it is a beautiful book. I very much agree with Matthew's assessment of it. It is, I'm sure, available at a discount. If anybody wants to give me a pound, I can send them a PDF. Free kids to feed, that's my own personal risk. And thank you, Austin, for writing.
Okay. I'm going to talk about the book as well, so I don't think Austin did a good job of keeping us away from that. But yes, I would like to start by thanking Austin, actually. I'm really delighted to be here, and I was particularly delighted to read those 212 pages. Actually, I again can highly recommend them, for all the reasons that we've already heard about. Austin got in touch with me a couple of months ago now to highlight, and he sent me an email talking, initially highlighting what we had in common in terms of research, which doesn't happen that often, actually, so I was really very pleased to hear from it. But he specified that we both work on risk, urban development, and Latin America. So the way I'm approaching this is to just go through and highlight some vignettes, really, from the book, and some key points from the book that resonate with my work, in a certain sense, on those things, but also have given me ideas in terms of future projects and how I can build up those ideas as well. Yeah. So as Claire said at the beginning, I'm a feminist geographer and I work on gender and risk. And so I was very engaged by the elements of Austin's book that looked at risk as a form of governance, and in particular the gendered elements of that. There's a lot of work on how men, masculinity and femininity relates to risk. I've mostly worked in the realm of finance, both finance down the road at the city and the financial crisis, and also finance in terms of microfinance. So in a nutshell, it tends to be that when men take financial risks, they're rewarded with a massive bailout and big kind of phallic buildings and things like that. And when women take financial risk, they're either reprimanded or not recognised for that risk. They tend to be more recognised for how sensible we are with money and responsibilities around that. And there was one moment in Austin's book when he talks about protest in Bogota from persons who'd been displaced, the majority of whom in Colombia are women. And the way that this protest that was in the park in the more salubrious part of town, the way that this protest was summarised or headlined by the powers that be was that these were vulnerable people who were possibly at being exploited, who were being exploited by somebody who is evil. Now, And Austin goes through a very nice way of translating Bibor. In my research in Colombia and Bolivia, actually, like, you hear Bibor a lot, and it's one of those words that doesn't really translate particularly well into English without at least a footnote, and I think you give it a couple of paragraphs. It means something slightly different in Medellin, which I'll get to in a second as well. But a Bibor, I think Austin defines it as urban charisma, a kind of masculine urban charisma, but it's the kind of wheeler-dealer who can find the opportunities in the market or whatever to kind of get his point across and win the deal. And the perception of this protest in Bogota was that these displaced people were vulnerable, not empowered, not demonstrating for their rights, not taking the initiative to protest on their own terms, but were vulnerable to these leaders who were men who were described as evil. The men in question also were not white, were not upper class, not like the boys in the financial sector getting the bailout. And they're not seen as, although perhaps the wheeler dealer is the kind of person who takes risks, who takes kind of market risks, they're not seen as valued in the same kind of way. And that I think that story, that vignette, brings out very well the way that risk is recognised as belonging to a certain kind of person as well. Risk has been very much about... risk is about how risk is managed. So having the knowledge and the expertise to manage risk makes you a financial expert rather than a gambler, for example. And the way that that story brings out as well is that women are often highlighted for their vulnerability. Even though they're taking on the risk, taking on the responsibility, I'm very aware Sylvia's sitting right here, they're taking on all the responsibility for development, but they tend to be highlighted, they tend to be seen in development terms in terms of their vulnerability. And to explicitly value the kind of approach that Austin's taken throughout the book in terms of looking critically at these discourses of development on the basis of very detailed ethnographic work, looking at the way that women negotiate that women are taking on that responsibility, can help problematize that kind of gendered dichotomy between risk and vulnerability. I mentioned that vivo means something very different in Medellin. From reading your book, I've worked in Medellin, and I don't know Bogota that well, but from Austin's definition, vivo is seen as quite a negative trait. I should highlight as well that Medellin and Bogota are quite competitive cities. They're quite there's sort of quite a rivalry between Medellin and Bogota. When I was in Medellin, vivo was often emphasised to me as a value. If somebody is wily enough or cunning enough to be a kind of wheeler-dealer type, that's something that's valued as a characteristic. And that was often part of the explanation that a lot of people had for why Medellin tended to be quite violent. And that reminded me as well of the way that that young men in Medellin, who were seen not because of their behaviour, but because of the kind of characteristics, the kind of young men they were, namely poor from excluded areas and from an indigenous or a rural background, would be targeted for violence sensitivity programs on the grounds that they were that kind of person. And I had one focus group with a group of teenagers who'd been involved in those sensitivity programs who were furious that they were being told that they haven't, that they were being trained out of doing something that they hadn't done yet. But because they were recognised as having these kind of characteristics, they ended up in that situation. So not only is that distinction between the vulnerable and the vivo, that gendered distinction, unfair to the women, but it's also pathologising young men in that context. Now, as I mentioned, there's a great deal of rivalry between Medellin and Bogota. Well, as Claire said at the beginning, I wrote a book about the Medellin model of urban development, the so-called Medellin miracle, that was based around that was called social urbanism. That was developed in the late 1990s and early 2000s. And something I really got out of reading Austin's book was the points of difference and comparison between the Medellin model and the Bogota model. Throughout Austin's book, there's this emphasis on the way that different discourses of development, and particularly urban development, are overlaid throughout time, and he very explicitly resists the kind of apocalypse thinking of thinking that modernity comes and then this kind of more neoliberal governmentality comes after that. I think it's fair to say that in comparison to the kind of techniques of risk that Austin is referring to, the Medellin model, the discourses around it that were established in the 1990s, speak much more to a modernising paradigm of development. The Medellin model, largely based on the Barcelona model, emphasised education. It targeted areas to be, the areas of intervention were targeted on the basis of the Human Development Index for each particular area. And the mayor that's most associated with this, Sergio Fajardo, was known as being a technocratic mayor who was moving away from more paternalist, vertical, feudal ideas of governance. However, that the way that that model has progressed, and I should say as well that no one mentioned the Bogotá model of urban development when I was in Medellin. That was the urban development model that dared not speak its name. But the Medellin model is continuing to progress and continuing to, you know, win quite high-profile prizes on the international stage. And the latest initiative is something called the Greenbelt Initiative that Medellin, in a particularly excluded comuna, informal settlement, in a particularly excluded and erstwhile violent informal settlement, Medellin is setting up a greenbelt. And that's an area that currently is inhabited by people who are at risk of landslides, etc. So exactly the kind of technical governance that Austin is talking about in Bogotá. And that's to be rezoned as a green area of parkland, recreation, cycling, etc. But most controversially, the aim of this greenbelt is to contain urban expansion. And it has been pointed out that the areas deemed at risk of landslide aren't the more salubrious areas with gated communities and very secure houses, etc. They are the areas that have the more informal housing. Now, the way that this resonates with the discourses of the 1990s is very interesting. When containing urban expansion was understood in terms of stopping Medellin being a magnet for immigration or in investing in surrounding areas to build up economy and livelihood opportunities in those surrounding areas. But the Greenbelt Initiative first started in 2011, which, as Austin points out as well, was a year where there were a lot of rains in Colombia, and that kind of disaster risk reduction discourse became more prominent. The way that that aim of containing the city and minimising the expansion in terms of informal slums has now been taken up with a very different discursive framework, I think emphasises Austin's point that these models of development don't go in a linear fashion, that they coincide at the same time. It also emphasises that the way that different discourses are used internally and as a face on the world is very different as well. The Greenbelt is speaking to international priorities of climate change and green areas, green parks, etc., and less so to the priorities of people in those particular areas. And the last point I'd like to bring out also speaks to Austin's resistance to that kind of apocalypse thinking, and it's been mentioned before as well, that it's very clear in this book that there's a resistance to a progressive idea of which cities are the most developed, a linear progression of which cities are the most developed. So at one point, Austin points out that history is believed to be moving backwards in the direction of Lima and Lagos rather than forwards towards Paris and New York. So the rise of cities in the global south is, it would appear, throwing a spanner in the works of how we normally think of the flow of time and the arrow of time. I entirely agree when he says that the way that this is being talked about reasserts the primacy or the assumed more advanced character of northern cities. So the vision of a world in which Lima and Lagos are the future of urban development is quite an apocalyptic one. But that got me thinking about, in relation to my current project as well, in terms of, that got me thinking about what kind of futures we're imagining for different cities, and how the points of reference are still very much situated in the developed global cities in the north. There's a lot of, a little bit of an aside, there's a lot of philosophy about the arrow of time, the flow of time, etc. When I've been working in Bolivia, I'm working with people who speak Aymaran, and the Aymaran language has had a lot of studies on it because it has an interestingly different configuration of time and space in its grammar. So, for example, if you're talking to someone Aymara and they refer to their ancestors, they'll probably point forward, and if they refer to next week, they might well indicate backwards. Now, loads of linguistics on this. I can say that I've worked in Bolivia for 10 years and I've never actually witnessed this. It's also obviously quite a problematic reconfiguring of time in that it implies that indigenous people are walking backwards through time or are resisting modernity and always looking to the past. But in Bolivia, the idea of problematizing that modernizing view of time is very prominent in policy. And it's particularly prominent in the way that people are seeing which kind of city they want to develop. So I want to draw on, with that in mind, I was really taken by Austin's postulation of the subjunctive state. I think Matthew mentioned this as well. As soon as I read it, I don't know if any of you have learned Spanish, but if you had, you probably spent hours memorising conjugations. The imperfect subjunctive, I can't imagine what an imperfect subjunctive state would look like, but that would be very complicated. But the subjunctive state is this idea that's been mentioned before as well, of anticipatory urban governance, that the way that urban citizens are being governed is in terms of being placed in a double bind and then encouraged to take a decision about a possible future without that future being particularly certain. And the example that Austin gives is people who need to be rezoned because they've been their house has been designated as at risk, and to be rezoned within the time that they will have the money to be able to do so, they have to put money down on a plot of land that has yet to be built. Yeah. In some of the trips, in some of the examples, there wasn't even a model there, but in some there was a model of what this urbanisation area was eventually going to look like. And that did make me think, to end on a slightly more positive note perhaps, that did make me think that of the different ways that people imagine the future city in informal settlements and the way that that is always predicated on in uncertainty. But often the way that that uncertainty is communicated, and certainly this comes through a lot in my personal experience when I'm researching in specifically in El Alto, that the way that that comes through is often more in terms of hope than risk. And that comes through in the examples that Austin gives as well. And as he says, it's often within this anticipatory domain and not outside or against it that the urban poor seek opportunities to make and remake their cities. And in Austin's book, there are many nice pictures actually, but there's one in particular of a model from a developer who's trying to encourage people from these at-risk areas to pay up front. Now in El Alto, which is a very, very different context to Bolivia, there are some similarities in that they're Andean cities, but it's a very different context. And in particular, the government hasn't got the data or the power to control risk in the same way as they're able to in Bogotá. But in El Alto, you also see models of houses, and they're the models of houses that people dream of having. And at this point, I wish I could show you a photo, because there are quite amazing buildings in El Alto, which is going through a boom at the moment. And the architect called Freddy Mamani, who makes the buildings, has gained quite a reputation. They're extremely brightly coloured, covered in glass, various Tiwanaku images all over them, so very much speaking to an Aymaran tradition. The architect isn't formally trained, he's like learnt on the job, etc. And these are very distinctive buildings that have become emblematic of El Alto. If you go to any of the fairs, where you can go and make various offerings in order to get your dream car, house, etc., you see stall upon stall of little models of these particular buildings. And the stalls themselves are quite a vision and make for an urban imaginary that certainly I hadn't thought of before I got there. So what I'd emphasise, and it's perhaps building on what Gareth said as well, is that there is room for that without wanting to be too romantic about ideas of hope, which of course hope is a necessary part to any tragedy, but there is room there to see these spaces that are very risky in a sense, but these spaces as areas of hope and different kinds of imagination that, as Austin put, we just have to consider what displacements of urban theory and practice are necessary to be able to perceive them.
Okay, thank you everybody for those really great reflections on the book. What I'd like to do is open the floor now to questions. What I'd like to do is take a couple of questions and then the panel members can respond as they see fit, and we'll come to Austin last, I think. So do we have any questions from on the floor? It's quite a lot to take in an hour. Yeah, without having read the book. I mean, one of the things I could do, actually, Austin, is I could ask you maybe to pick, because actually a lot of questions were raised by each of the panel, the panelists, and do you actually want to respond briefly to some of those comments?
Absolutely. I mean, I want to respond first. I think I'll just stay here, if that's all right. I mean, just first of all, I just want to respond immediately to say how incredibly generous all of those readings were. And not just in the sense of sort of, you know, softball kind of generous, but generous in the sense of really kind of trying to figure out what I was trying to do with the book in parts that were probably not always totally clear, and really reading it with, I think, a very generous eye to understanding what it was trying to do, and I think ultimately the kinds of summaries that you've just heard, or the kinds of extensions of the book that you've just heard, far surpass actually what the book does in and of itself. So I wish I could somehow, maybe this will be a podcast that I could transcribe and sort of condense into written form, and then somehow like substitute it for the book itself, because those were really amazing commentaries on it. And I hope if you do take a look at the book that it at all sort of like compares to what was just said about it. So thank you for those. Some of the questions that emerged, I mean, there were a lot of them, and I'm not sure that I can really do justice to them. The one somehow that comes to mind immediately was Gareth's question about humor.
Because
I do think it doesn't come across in the book too much, and there are many sort of examples I could think of. One in particular was a kind of common refrain that people mentioned in various forms, but one woman said it in particular. This was somebody being relocated from a zone of high risk to another sort of yet-to-be-built settlement further on the periphery of the city. She said something like, "The mountains of the rich are high class, the mountains of the poor are high risk." So a kind of like this sort of, it sounds actually even better in Spanish. But
go on, then.
It's that kind of humor that is, I mean, it's sort of cuts through, you know, some of the kind of class politics, some of the kind of questions as to, you know, what are the motivations behind the program for resettling populations living in zones of high risk. But yet, often the humor was much less skeptical than that. That was a particularly sort of skeptical version. And to try to think of, you know, other forms. I mean, there's a kind of wistful, almost humorous sort of "si Dios quiera," like if God willing, things will kind of turn out right. And often people said that with a kind of humorous smile and sort of look in their eye. Of course, the use of "quiera" there is subjunctive, and it's if God would will something to happen. So that was often used with a kind of humor as well, both in terms of that kind of subjunctive looking ahead to various possible futures, the need to make a certain kind of decision based on that, as well as in some ways, a conflation or configuration between God and the state. So a really interesting way in which both people working for the municipal government, as well as those people subject to these resettlement programs that I'm talking about, didn't necessarily see this as a purely kind of technical or technocratic sort of form of governance, but actually engaged with it on many levels, some of which were deeply oriented towards thinking through religious or sort of theological imaginaries of the future, some of them more utopian, some of them more dystopian. So those kinds of sort of comments always did strike me as well as really worth taking seriously, often in terms of their actual incisiveness. So thanks for bringing that up. Many other questions to sort of respond to, but I see at least one finger.
Yeah,
thank you for the talk. It was really interesting. I was wondering about something that nobody talks about, and which could be a future book or project perhaps, but I was wondering what the panel thought about endangered villages and the rural, the rural seems to be further away from perhaps a lot of the protection of the state, which people, even though it's dangerous, as you said, the police could have an effect. They could be taking your door down and stealing your stuff. But they're further away from it. There seems to be more danger there. And although this isn't a danger that doesn't exist in the urban, there's also the danger of almost extinction. Villages could be dying. And when they die, the people are more likely to go to a city. So do you have any thoughts on endangered villages, endangered morality, and what that extinction could mean for cities? And maybe it's already having an effect. They're bringing their ideas of extinction and endangerment to the city. They're probably less rooted and situated.
Does anybody want to respond to that briefly?
I mean, it's your show. I could say a few words to that. I think it's a really interesting question, partially because of the degree to which the armed conflict in Colombia has for a long time been essentially a rural conflict, an agrarian conflict over land and ideas of land redistribution, and the ways in which I think the city is figured within that kind of late 20th century imaginary. The city is in some ways a kind of refuge from that rural form of violence and of, and I think, I mean, the others on the panel may be able to sort of put this in more comparative context, but I think there's a broader sort of story, at least within Latin America, that where the city and the rural are in this sort of civilization versus kind of barbarism sort of framework, where the rural sort of barbaric, often extremely violent, and an uncivilized eventually sort of comes, fear that it will eventually come and take over the city. So I think rather than sort of dichotomize the sort of urban as a either safe or as an endangered space versus the rural, I think there's a way in which that whole sort of spatial relationship between the countryside and the city, between the rural and the urban, in Colombia, certainly throughout the 20th century, but this was written about in the 19th century in Argentina as well, is very much understood through this kind of endangered and threat sort of framework to a certain degree. So I think, I mean, that's just to say that that conversation, I think, is a broader one to have with not just sort of, you know, capital cities or the big cities like Bogota or even Medellin.
Does anybody want to very briefly add anything to that? Otherwise, I'm going to...
Well, I mean, I think it's a really interesting question. I think if you go to Austin's book, plug that, he does actually make the kind of opening sort of discussion is a sort of non-city example with the mudslides, etc. From the context of Mexico, I think there is certainly a sort of shift through the 20th into the 21st century. Two phrases which relate to the village slash the city, I think, are kind of symptomatic of that. One is that in Spanish, pueblo means both people and village. And yet today, when people talk about people, they talk about citizens and they urbanize the people. So almost as if from the lexicon of the people, the village has disappeared. And I think that's kind of symptomatic of a sort of urbanization and a political urbanization of the country. And which maybe relates to the second way in which people describe more vernacular the village, which is they describe it as those left behind. and in which it's essentially often described as old women and children. Though that is the kind of 21st century caricaturization of a village in Mexico. The city is masculine, it's youthful, etc., etc., whereas the village is a space which seems to be, you know, back in time. That's a standard sort of trope, cliche, if you like, but it's actually a phrase which is increasingly used to describe those who are there, that they're it's a space of those left behind. And it's actually formed into policy now, what to do with those left behind, sort of temporally, mobility-wise, etc.
Okay, thank you. I think I'm going to close now, so if you have more questions, you can always come and talk to Austin. But yeah. I mean, I'm going to go back to where Austin started, which was with the weather and in the context of endangerment. And since it's rather warm in this room, I think that we need to refresh ourselves. So I would like to thank you all very much for coming, and particularly like...